This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Everybody, this is Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. In the studio, I am gifted by my associate once again, Jeremy Spiegel, Dr. Jeremy Spiegel. Jeremy, welcome back.
Thank you, Armand.
And nice to have you here thinking with me. Gaddafi. Let's talk about Gaddafi. Now, the Gaddafi forces struck back at the rebels with his military, and he was convinced that he would, he's doing something for justice. And one of the things that Gaddafi is quoted as saying is, "My people love me, they would die for me." I thought about that. I thought Saddam Hussein had said the same thing. I think about other people who have this belief that people love them. I remember when I was in Cuba hearing that about Castro. And I'm not saying that it's wrong. I mean, maybe the people do love him. Maybe the people would die for him. I'm not sure. But that belief that you have, that people feel a certain way towards you, that's what our show's about today. Today the program's about, what do people think of you? What do people think of you? How do you think people see you? If you were to say, most people think of me, would you say they fear you? Or they cherish you? Do most people dislike you? Are you invisible? Are you somebody who a person doesn't even notice? Do people worry about you? Are you one of these people who look like you're always broken and they want to take care of you? Do they judge you? Do people see you as a resource? Like, you know, if you're a parent, you're the one with the money, the influence, the car. Or you could even be a resource if you're a co-pilot. Let's say you're my girlfriend and we go to bars together, and I have you there on my side. Now, one of the things that's most upsetting in life is what happens to people when they find out they were not seen the way they thought they were seen. So if you think you have a good buddy, and you think you're trustworthy, and your friend gossips about you and tells something about you and betrays you in a way, you get very upset. But the reason we get so upset is because we had built up this myth. We had built up this story about how we were seen. It's not so much the betrayal. It's our story.
Exactly. You know, It's very true that none of us live in a vacuum, and how we view ourselves is directly proportional to the messages, the unconscious, the unspoken messages that we get from those around us,
and the messages that we want to get. So the real truth is, how do people see me? How do I want people to see me? How do I make up how people see me? Right?
Exactly. And it begs the question, who is it exactly that you're spending the most time with? Are these people a genuine reflection of the true you, or is it something else? There's a lot at issue here.
Well, true you is a big issue. Who knows what a true you really is? I don't know what a true me is. Right? But let's get to this one thing about people and how they perceive me. So in my asking the question, how does somebody see me, does the man who the man who sells the newspaper downstairs from where I live, how does he see me? Mm. Every day when I come out of my building, does he see me as a potential customer, that same guy that he sees every morning? Does he see me as a nice man? I think he sees me as a nice man. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he resents me.
Maybe he knows something about you that you yourself do not know that he knows about you.
That's right. That's right. Something he could have heard about it. So the question, this is a very important question, friends. To all of you, I ask you, how do people think of you? It's worth questioning. Let's talk about being trustworthy. The other day, somebody was asking me a question, and the question I thought was meant in jest. And when I answered the question, I answered it with a little sarcasm. It's like somebody said, do you think the world would die if I don't turn off the stove? And I said, yes, the world would die. It was that kind of silly thing. Mm-hmm. But when I looked at this person's face, I realized they didn't realize I was kidding. And I said, oh, I just wounded them. In fact, I just told them through sarcasm that I'm not to be trusted. And I apologized. People who are sarcastic are telling people, don't trust me ever. Because if you're sarcastic, that means if you're telling people things that aren't true, you're keeping people off balance. And if you're keeping people off balance, they can never trust you, because one of the things we know about people is that people who are off balance, they don't like it. They want to be on balance. So being trustworthy can get you a lot of stuff, but it's very hard to be trustworthy. It's very hard to maintain your own honesty with people. What are some of the ingredients of that? Well, consistency, for sure. That's one. Do you have secret exit strategies, as a lot of people do? I know a lot of people who commit themselves absolutely to everything. And then when you're not looking, they leave. They don't show up, right? Then you get upset with them. These people are called passive-aggressive. But passive-aggressiveness only upsets you because the rest of the time, they're feeding you. You see, the rest of the time, their niceness is feeding you. And you're believing that their niceness means that they really like you. Mm. What you're not seeing is that that person is not capable of telling you when you offend them. And so they're going to get even.
It's incredible how that happens. The consistency, what you're describing, the consistency... And to also have the capacity to bear someone's confidence, I think are really essential ingredients to trustworthiness.
When you first meet someone, so we developed a test. Here's a good test. Imagine, I want you all to think of your best friend, or somebody you know, or me, Armand. And say you were going to tell somebody, you should listen to the Positive Mind, because... And then you're going to answer that question, right? Because he, and then just fill in the blanks. In fact, we're going to take some calls from you around that very issue. Why should someone listen to the Positive Mind? And you're going to say, because this show does this and this and this. Okay. But if someone were to introduce you to a social setting, how would they introduce you? I'd like you to meet Jeremy. He's a boomer, 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 boomer. How would I describe him? He's a nice man. He's a good-looking man. He's an intelligent man. what would you say? What would people say about you? Now, my friends, most of you would not want to take the time to think about this, because you don't think this is an exercise worthwhile, but I tell you, this is a very worthwhile exercise. Let's say you were single and you were looking for a mate. How would somebody introduce you? But I like the one about friends the most. If I'm going to introduce you to my friends, what would I say about you? Here, I'd like you to meet this person. Our telephone number here today is 212-209-2900. Now, we haven't taken calls for weeks because it's been the fun drive. And today I want to leave a lot of room for telephone calls. And mainly, I want to talk about how people perceive you and how you get people to perceive you. Let's look for a moment at something like Facebook or Match.com. You go on Match. It's an attempt to represent yourself in a positive light that will attract someone. So when people connecting through these sites, they start filtering out. Okay, what do you want? What don't you want? So the first thing you do is you look at their picture, right? And you see, if you see a picture, you say, well, fat, skinny, tall, short, age. You eliminate. You start crossing people off that way, just physically. I don't want that one. I don't want that one. I don't want that one. Then you do the clothing they're wearing, believe it or not. Oh, that one's wearing sports clothes, or that one's wearing a tie. And you eliminate that way. Then you look at, are they married or not? If you suspect married, you know, you eliminate them. If they say in their thing, separated but not divorced, you may eliminate. You may not. You look at their work. Are they employed? No, hasn't had a job for a while. Creative artist, unemployed. Eliminate. You look at their religious belief. You know, devout Lutheran. You know, maybe yes, maybe no. You actually eliminate people. You cross them off. And you get down to like 100. And then you look at that 100 and you know out of that 100, maybe there'll be somebody who could actually talk to and connect with. But mostly, what you've got to spend the rest of your time doing is finding out what the lies are. Who is this person? You've had this experience, Lauren? Tell me about it. Lauren's here. She's nodding her head, having been through this a bit.
Just like how you said that you feel like it's really important how people view within a friendship circle, because much like with dating, I feel like it's equivalent to a business relationship, because it's kind of like you're putting your best face forward to get, you know, a result. And I feel like a lot of the times, guys and girls go into dating with lies, with an act that they're trying to present instead of just being their true self, because they're trying to reap whatever benefit from the other person.
So, you know, one of the ways of reaping a benefit is to look like you're strong as opposed to fragile.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Nobody buys fragile, but some people like fragile. But most people present themselves as stronger than they are. They have more together than they are.
And I think you touched on that with the sarcasm. I think a lot of guys hide behind sarcasm as kind of like a defense mechanism.
So if you see sarcasm, you automatically say, oops.
A bit, but
if it's there all the time.
If it's there all the time, then that's like a red flag.
Yeah, you wonder. It makes you wonder how many people I see who use that as part of their way of talking. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're talking about how people perceive you and how you want to be perceived. I remember a sign I once saw in a diner. It said, one day I hope to be the person that my dog thinks I am. You know, because your dog always loves you, admires you, and thinks you're this incredible hero. One day I hope to be that real person in real life. So if you were being introduced, how would you want to be introduced? Now, there are people, do you know, who know you, who are waiting for you to fail. There are very few who are looking for you to succeed more than they do. It's one of human frailties.
That's sad. It's very sad. We don't talk about this. We only talk about this with respect to celebrities and with their inevitable peak and then downfall, the Schadenfreude, the joy of someone else's downfall. This is very common. Very common, but secret. I mean, I don't think that anyone would readily admit this. But I think there is something natural to this. Why should that be?
Something natural about wanting the other person to fail.
It's like
imagine if it's... maybe it goes all the way back to the Battle of the Sperm. You know what I mean? They're all fighting for the same egg. And you want the guy in front of you. If he falls down, you climb over him. And you keep going,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
it's like it's all the way through that battle. We're hoping that the other guy doesn't get where we want to go. So there's some basic quality that says, I hope you fail.
Yeah.
I agree with that to an extent because I feel like dependent upon your relationship with the other person, like you might be able to reap some of the benefits of their success.
Yes. I agree with that. That's great. 212-209-2900 is our number. We will be taking your calls today because we want to hear your calls. But how are you perceived? And have you had an example of where you thought you were perceived one way and you were truly perceived another? 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hello?
Yes, I hear you.
Armand, how are you?
Good. Who is this?
This is long time no call. Austin from Jersey.
Hey, Austin, I haven't heard from you in a while. Nice to hear your voice.
I try to give others a chance, so I resist the temptation to call every other day, which is a bit of a hyperbolic statement, but anyway. I just wanted to say that regarding lying is a funny thing because I think we all like to make this big, have this big taboo about lying, and I think there's a difference between. And I think this is a big guy issue. We lie to get our foot in the door. It doesn't necessarily mean we're pathological liars and going to lie and everything, or to use lying as an offensive tool. You know, if you're under-actualized in terms of a profession or whatever, sometimes you bend the truth or you say an outright lie to get your foot in the door, to get somewhere, and to see that the same as someone who's going to lie. And take someone's inheritance are two very different things. That we are along a continuum, and people will lie at different times to protect themselves, and that's very different from the pathological liar who's coming from a very, very dark place.
I fully understand. What about you, though? How do people perceive you?
You know, it's hard to say because I don't know how open I am to wanting to hear that in the full, even though I would like to think that I do. And I use sarcasm sparingly. I think sarcasm is something that gets nauseating with people who use it too much. But it's a nice kind of testing tool because I think there are different ways that people use sarcasm, and a good barometer of humor is a person who uses it judiciously, uses it. You know,
but Austin, why do you want to test people?
Why
do you just let people see who you are and be who you are? And
maybe I'm terrified because I have some huge senses of deficiency within myself. So
that's a very important thing. If you feel deficient inside yourself, it's very hard. It's very hard to be yourself.
Well, it's also the paradox of, like, you know, that it said that we want guys to be open, and then when you're open and honest, we don't want that. That's too open. So where do you draw the line, you know? The common notion is that being open in front of everything is the best thing, when in reality it doesn't give the best results all the time. You know, in a support group, but in the real world of dating, and not necessarily so.
But could you imagine, Austin, down the line? I got a call from a friend today who said, a woman said, I've got to get out of the rut because I have to get back into doing things because I'm not busy anymore and I used to like to be busy. And I said, so why don't you relax? Why don't you not be busy? and reap the benefits of your life. And she said, I can't. So we said we had to talk about that. Mm. At this point in your life, Austin, why don't you just relax? What would happen if Austin was just Austin? Do you really think that there's so many deficiencies that you'd get nothing out of life? Because I know you. I know you from the radio. You're a beautiful man. Why can't I just see this part of you more often? Why can't I see this part of you out in the world?
Maybe it has to do with, and maybe this is me copping out, but maybe it has to do with the sense of the consumerist society that thinks that everything is about presentation, and it's better to be rejected for presenting something that's not you than to be rejected for a real you. Maybe it's more frightening to put oneself out there. Even if putting oneself out there is a passive thing, because I hear what you're saying. Sometimes just being yourself is the most relaxed and easy thing to do.
Well, it's not. It's scary.
Yeah.
Because you got an open belly, because somebody could come along and eat you up, you know what I mean? But
yeah, so
it has to be the goal.
What's the answer here? Where
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. I know what the question is. The question is, why do we continue to have to be who we're not and then get treated by people for who we're not and then get angry and saying, oh, that person never saw me in the first place when we never showed ourselves?
Because as silly as it sounds, it's less painful to be rejected for who you're not than to be rejected for who you are.
Wow.
Is that too simplistic?
Austin, that's perfect. That's perfect. Say it again.
You want me to copyright this?
Say that again.
It's more painful to be rejected for who you are than who you are not.
Wow. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's the way I said it the first time, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Thank you, Albert.
212, the wisdom of our WBAI audience. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand.
Yes, Armand, everyone.
Hey.
Yeah, Monroe here. Yeah.
Hey, Monroe.
Yeah, listen, I have to agree with Austin about things, where he says you just can't, you want to be as honest as you can be. And on the other hand, the world doesn't exactly like your form of honesty. You know what I'm saying?
I do, absolutely know, especially with you.
BAI is...
Especially with you. But, you know, yours is always the trouble with you. Is you see, like, even this moment, I like you.
Yeah, but
and
I'm
even
not,
this moment, what you're doing, your life... you're going to sneak on the air and say something about WBAI.
Oh, but, I mean, we're on WBAI.
I know, but
I'm saying that WBAI is trying to be the a forum for truth. Democracy Now!, Hugh Hamilton's talk back. Theoretically, we're all trying to reach understanding, which is truth. Understanding and improvement on understanding, right? Hello?
Well, you see, Monroe, I'm trying to relate to the individual and what it is you. I'm talking to people, and I'm asking them to talk about themselves.
Right.
And you're talking about the station.
No, I'm talking about myself. I'm a 50-year member of WBAI because I believe in myself and I believe in the aims of the station, Lou Hill's great advancement and how the media should be. It should be supported by the people so that the truth will come out and we'll have a better society for all the people. Hello?
Well, okay, Monroe, thank you very much.
Well, the point is, Armand, I just say this to you. If you can recommend me to any people that you know who you think I'd be compatible with, although I'm compatible with everyone, even people that dislike me, I try to appreciate and understand what they're all about. So thank you.
You're welcome, Monroe. And, you know, I do speak kindly of you all the time. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand. This is Quasi.
Hey, Quasi.
Hi. This is a consistent, superb program by you, of course. But I think your assessment of human nature or human character as being, as in at least one assessment, that we don't like to see others surpass us, I think that's faulty. I think that's inaccurate.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Tell me what evidence you have for that, because I would love it to be inaccurate.
I think that it's almost instinctive or considered instinctive for a parent to wish that his offspring surpassed.
For sure. For sure with your children, yes.
And also, even with your siblings, I would hope. At least that's the way it is with mine.
Okay,
me and
that
mine.
Makes sense, too. Yes.
And I extend it to my extended family. I must, you're welcome. I mean, you're entitled to disagree.
I don't disagree.
You know, but I mean, even your teachers, they certainly, when you meet them, they have surpassed you in certain respects. And I think you're happy that they're at an elevated station or state of development. And I think they hope for you to surpass them.
Sounds to me like you're a very nice man who loves people. And that you don't necessarily give in to that primal urge to see people jump when they're on the bridge.
Well, you know, let me tell you something, Armand. I mean, your program, I mean, I'm human. You know, that whole issue about being sarcastic, just the other day I was very sarcastic with my lady. And it came out of insecurity on my part. Why couldn't I just tell her about what I disliked in her actions.
So you see,
honestly.
You see that in yourself.
Yes, yeah,
when
course.
You are sarcastic.
Why sarcastic?
Yeah.
Maybe a defense mechanism.
That's right, that's right. But what do you think about that? I mean, now when you see yourself do it, do you help yourself hold
no,
back
I,
a little?
No, you're just enlightening me today. You know, I said no more.
Yeah.
No more. I can't go that route.
No
and that whole thing about being honest, and I mean, what that is a betrayal of trust to be sarcastic. That is dehumanizing to myself as well as to others.
Beautiful. Beautiful. What teachers we have here on the air. No, I thank you. Having that insight is beautiful. I saw it. I saw the look on the person's first face when I said it. And I said, oh, my God, what did I do?
Well,
that person
again, I thank you, and I continue to be a listener.
Thank you very
and
much.
And I'll take no more of your time. I sit to learn.
What's your name?
Kwesi.
Kwesi?
From South Ozone Park.
From South Ozone Park. Kwesi, thank you very much.
I called several times about in past programs about sociopaths.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, we got to talk about them in a minute, too.
Oh, great.
Thanks,
okay. Kwesi. I listen to learn. Thank you.
Yes, you know, Jeremy and I were talking about psychopaths. He works with the prison population a bit, right?
Yeah, well, I have, certainly over the years, and ultimately there are some people coming
from
prison.
So how do people perceive you is very important in a prison, right? You've got to put yourself up there as a certain position, and people barely know who you are.
Right.
But the thing about the sociopath is very often they believe they are good.
Mm. Yeah.
They believe they're just. They believe they're right even if they have to kill you. They believe.
Mm.
So they believe that everybody sees them wrong by seeing them as a bad person. And that's a real trap. So one of the things that happened to us is we believe that we're just. We believe we have the right judgment. We believe we have the right to criticize people. We believe it. And therefore, everybody's wrong about us. Boy, that's a trap.
Yeah. Well, can you imagine going through life where you really have no clue? You have no clue, or very little, how others view you.
And that's the way most people are. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I'll play you some music, and we'll be back with more of this programming. I'll be right back, my friends.
Every morning find me moaning.
Yes, Lord.
Cause of all the trouble I see.
Yes, Lord.
Life's a losing gamble to me.
Yes, Lord.
Cares and woes have got me moaning.
Yes, Lord.
Every evening find me moaning.
Yes, Lord.
I'm alone and crying the blues.
Yes, Lord.
I'm so tired of paying these dues.
Yes, Lord.
Everybody knows I'm moaning.
Yes, Lord. Lord, I spent plenty of days and nights along with my grief, along with my grief. Lord, I pray, really do pray, somebody will come and make me
every morning find me
Yes, Laura.
Life's a losing gamble to me.
Yes, Laura.
Cares and woes have got me moaning.
Yes, Laura.
Everybody knows I'm moaning.
Yes, Lord. Lord, I try, really and truly try, to find some relief, find some relief. Lord, I spent plenty of days of mine, along with my grief, along with my grief. Lord, I pray, pray, find some relief.
Lambert Hendricks and Ross moaning. Moaning, moaning, moaning. Yes, now here we are talking about, just as we were just walking into this program, about psychopathy and how people perceive you. Now, Jeremy, let's talk about it, psychopathy and sociopathy.
Yeah, psychopathy is, it's a term, the psychopath is a term that's used incorrectly, I guess you might say. It's certainly used by the media. Anybody who commits an egregious act is a psychopath, regardless what underlying mental illness they might have or what have you, because the act itself is so egregious that it really almost doesn't matter what you call the person. However, there really is an emerging science around all this, And the psychopath is not just your run-of-the-mill, antisocial person who's committed crime. The psychopath is something special. And only a certain percentage of the people who you might consider antisocial, somebody who's done violated the law or violated someone else's rights, only a certain percentage of those people are genuine psychopaths. And there's been a whole study of it. The man that comes to mind is Hare. He's the most famous psychologist, researcher on psychopathy. He's developed a scale where you can try to figure out, is this person in front of me a true psychopath? Does this person have a severe emotional detachment, which really separates the wheat from the chaff here when you're talking about is this person a genuine psychopath or does this person have psychopathy?
Emotional detachment like James Bond?
Well,
there's an emotional detachment.
Well, that's an interesting question because, of course, psychopathy is understood now as probably a very large spectrum, an idea, that there may be people walking around with elements of psychopathy, that detachment. I mean, there's somebody who might be even a neurosurgeon might have, or another kind of surgeon.
So detachment itself is not the criteria, but
no.
It's one of the criteria.
Yeah.
What are the others?
Yeah, I mean, again, you can always collect a few criteria for any disorder. It doesn't mean that you actually have the no, but truly, I think the idea is that you have a grandiosity, you have an enlarged sense of worth that may not quite ring accurate.
Like a sense of importance, like Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Remember in Taxi Driver where he has the. He felt like he represented justice, mm-hmm. Robert De Niro, in that, which is a perfect picture of what a psychopath is.
Yeah, exactly. There could be pathological lying. This person tends to be very cunning, very manipulative. And yet, importantly, there's no remorse. They're detached from what the rest of us might experience because we, you know, have an active emotional connection, emotional life. But for somebody with psychopathy, they have a very shallow, what they call a shallow affect.
How do they want to be seen, Jeremy? How does a person who's a psychopath want to be seen by the world?
Well, I mean, a true psychopath would be the life of the party. I'm picturing somebody who most people haven't figured it out.
Trustworthy.
Yeah.
The main thing you're doing is dancing around trust.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get you to trust me.
Yeah.
I'm going to get you to trust me. Every psychopath, I remember the guy who stole the Alzheimer's Foundation's membership list and called people who had Alzheimer's and told them they forgot to send their check. And he collected a lot of money that way. That's the story as I heard it. So you're exploitive, but the main way you're being exploitive is to get people to trust you. I got to get you to trust me. I'm going to sell you this car. I'm a car salesman. I'm a salesman of sorts. Or I'm just going to get you to trust me.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the characteristics, the so-called glibness, where, you know, I tend to think of a certain car salesman's salesman that I've met, but certainly the idea is that there's a real detachment, and in fact there is evidence through neuroimaging that they process emotion differently. So, for example, one could say that the psychopath has no capacity for empathy, but that's actually not really right on. It's a certain kind of empathy. It's a cold, calculating empathy that they have. So they could read emotion, but they don't feel it. They don't feel it.
So they could tell, if you're a psychopath, you could tell if somebody's afraid, and you could sense their fear, and that's a kind of empathy. And then you exploit that fear.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Right, it's not like you're empathizing,
right,
and you're giving some room for that, or you're taking care of the person. It's using the empathy as a way of exploiting the person even further. Wow.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think I actually don't love the use of the word empathy here because, in a way, it's so cold and calculated,
right,
that it's more kind of figuring out. Using maybe a different part of the brain to figure out, okay, what is this emotional environment that I'm stepping into,
mm-hmm,
as a means to know what I'm getting into, so that way I can manipulate appropriately or effectively, as opposed to the so-called hot empathy, which is the empathy that we all sort of know about, you know.
So Match.com must be a field day for people like this. I mean, you could just play all day long and see how you could manipulate the all the variables.
Yeah, I mean,
see if you could get what you want. I met a man once who said he has never made a Match.com connection where he didn't have sex with the person. He said it's like it'll be within 24 hours because he knew how to manipulate all the variations, all the variables.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, yeah. It can really become sinister. I mean, if you think about it. And yet at the same time, can you imagine for a minute, can you imagine if all of your decision-making were devoid of true feeling behind it? I mean, what would that do? What would that be like?
Say it again.
In other words, that if you were not genuinely, if you had no genuine feelings for the people that you were making a decision for or among, what would your decisions be like?
It reminds me of somebody who's got something for sale. Let's say you sell vitamins. You got vitamins in your name, right? And all you're going to do is sell. You got to buy this vitamin. And all I care about is you're going to buy the vitamin. I no longer care about your well-being.
Yeah.
I care you're going to buy my product. Or if you're a salesman, if you run a business. It's kind of funny. I mean, most of the people in business, they eventually get to that spot. I don't care. I just want you to buy my product. So that's not all psychopathy.
No. And certainly, as you describe it, I mean, I think you're describing the kind of fatigue that happens to some people in certain careers where ultimately it becomes very much the bottom line for them and that all joy is lost. I mean, I think that's
when I meet physicians who do procedures, right, there are three kinds of physicians. One does procedures. That means they go in and they do surgery. Another one sells pills, right? I don't know what the third one is because I haven't met him yet. So they only have, you know, either you're gonna, I'm gonna write you a prescription, or I'm gonna sell you a procedure. Now all I have to do is what I'm thinking is, I have to figure how much insurance is gonna reimburse me for this procedure. So when you walk in, my first question to everybody who goes to a doctor, you could always hear, not at my office, this doesn't happen, but what's the first question? What's your insurance? That means how much can we get out of you through the insurance company? And then we'll determine what the procedure is going to be that you're going to need.
Hmm.
And the medical system has turned somewhat psychopathic, you know, by the sale of all these materials. You, doctor, Mr. Big Shot, MD, you feel like you just want to sell a procedure?
No, of course not, Armand. But I mean, I think, yeah. I mean, I
see sarcasm.
I don't see the world quite that black and white. With the
neither what, do I. Yeah, it's okay. Just like pushing the edge.
Yeah. But certainly.
So, what could you do if you're in this kind of situation? One of the things, you're never going to recognize it in yourself. If you're a psychopath, you're not going to see it.
Mm.
So if you see it in someone else, the one thing you want to do is don't try to fix it.
Exactly. You're talking about if
you determine the guy you're with is a psychopath, don't try to fix it. You're not going to do it. I don't think you're going to do it. Will love cure a psychopath?
Love won't, but you know...
But electroshock may.
Well, do you know what's very interesting too is because usually, usually we say about these individuals that there's really nothing you can do about it, but that's really not exactly the case. At least in the sense that there was a relatively recent study that came to my attention where they looked at juveniles with psychopathic traits. And the ones that had a kind of a psychotherapeutic intervention ends up, they counted how many times they reoffended, and it was significantly different than the other group that did not have this. So there may well be something that could be done early, but there may also be a kind of a critical stage where you really can't fix it, at least yet.
In your work in the prisons, have you seen any group therapy as an attempt to kind of make a dent in it?
Well, I haven't seen much, I'll say this. I have not seen much, yeah. Because I think the best psychopath can tell you, maybe better than the person leading the group, what is right and what isn't, you know?
Right.
And they know, but... but that doesn't, unfortunately, often amount to very much.
Thank you very much. 212-209-2900. We're talking about the psychopath as part of the personalities, but it is basically how are you seen? How do people see you? Have people gotten the wrong idea about you? How do people keep getting the wrong idea about you? What is it that you put out there that makes people keep thinking you're a pushover or you're stronger than you are? 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Going to be with you today, Tuesday and Wednesday. It gets confusing at times of this week. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Tina.
Hello, Tina.
This is a very interesting question that you have presented to us. and I've been pacing back and forth since I've been waiting on the phone to speak to you. And I think it's a good question to present to anyone that you may know of in your life. In fact, I like it because...
So how would you, Tina, how would somebody introduce you to their friends? If somebody said, we're going to have a birthday party, I'm going to invite Tina. So how would your best friend describe Tina?
Okay, my best friend. Okay, and then I'll think of Ebony. She'll say she is outgoing. She is, outgoing, observant, generous, serious nature, expressive, supportive. And this is from getting to know me over the years.
I hear you've been doing some work. Is she nice?
Who's nice? Tina, me, or
Tina? Abby? Yeah, Tina.
You see that word there? I'm beyond nice.
Go ahead.
To the point where I'll give you an example. I'm with someone, and I met him 2 years ago, and right now, okay, he is a recovering addict. And most women probably wouldn't deal with someone like that. But I see him for who he is. And he has a lot to offer. So because of the way my heart condition is, I began to get to know him and became involved. And one of my girlfriends considered me to be the one of the last of Mohicans. So I've come into his life, and I see a 360 from May up until now. His home, the way that he's living right now in terms of himself. Even people in his circle, they see a difference.
Do you think love made the difference?
I'm sorry?
Do you think love made the difference?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I believe you. Yes, I believe you. I believe, you know, here's what I believe. I believe he was ready to change, and you were ready to change. And the two of you met at the perfect time, just as the change was taking place. And he moved away from his addictions, and he moved towards embracing some kind of affection. So I think it wasn't love cured him, but he was ready. And so were you.
So then if it wasn't love that cured him, does love play a role in this relationship?
Of course it does. Of course it does. But what is love? I mean, I'm not going to really go into that definition.
No.
But how does he see you, Tina? How does he see you? Does he see you as who you are? Or does he see you as different than you are?
One thing I love about him is that he can be truthful, and that's where the change comes in on what you just stated, a change that took place between he and I. Because there's things about him that I admire and that has helped me to see an area that I need to work on, and I've told him this. He sees me to be the same way that I express that my girlfriend sees me.
And do both of them know you? Is anybody missing one aspect of Tina?
Can you repeat that again, please?
Is there any one aspect of Tina that everybody misses? Like how scared you are?
Very good question. Ebony has known me longer. Let's see, is there an area that she misses?
What about that? What about how scared you are?
Me scared?
You scared, yeah.
I don't know if I'm... My life, the way it is right now, is... You and I would have to be to sit down for you to really get to understand. Scared? I don't know about so much about being scared. I don't sense that.
Good.
With me.
I like the way you asked the question. Well, Tina, you sound like a lovely person. I thank you very much. Congratulations on your relationship. And thanks for your help with us.
Thank you.
Sure. Keep tuning in. And don't pace anymore.
Say it again?
Don't keep pacing.
I was patient, and I wanted to so bad talk to you, and I've been listening to you for so long.
Oh, that's so nice.
And
So nice, so thank you very much.
No, very true, very true. And it was a very good question, because now I want to ask people that I know, you know, what do you think of me?
Well, you see, that's a trap. You can't ask that. What do you think of me? No, they're not going to tell you the truth. Say, but if you had to introduce me, how would you introduce me?
Work. Oh, if you wanted to introduce me, how would you introduce me?
That's much better.
And that would let me know how much you've really gotten to know me and how you really think of me.
Or how I presented myself to you is really what it is. Not how much you got to know me, but how much I have shown you.
Oh, how much I have shown you.
Thanks for calling in, Tina.
Thank you. Have a good day now.
Thank you. 212-209-2900. We got time for another call. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
My name is Frank. I'm from Long Island.
Hello, Frank.
This topic is fascinating that I just tuned in because I've been studying it as I discovered about 6 months ago. There is a science of psychopathy. So,
yes.
Okay. Do you know about the book by a Polish psychiatrist, Political Ponadology?
No. Do you know that, Jeremy? No. Good.
All right. Let me give you the spelling because I think
sure.
it's important. It's spelled P-O-N-E-R-O-L-O-G-Y. Ponados is the Greek word for evil. So this is the genesis of evil in politics.
Hmm.
And it scares me because, as he says here, 4 to 8%, they're not sure, of any given population is psychopathic. And most of us think of a psychopath like Charles Manson, you know?
Yeah.
But they're not. They're very normal looking.
Did you ever have anybody like that in your family?
I think so. But
I think so, too. I could hear it.
Yeah.
Where was the damage? From on top, right? From your parents.
See, what really worries me is that what he says in this book is that these people are the ones who work their way to the top of any organization.
But I was asking you about growing up with it.
They tipped the organization into evil.
Yeah.
Now,
so your whole family got thrown into that, right?
Well, what happens, he describes them as people who, they're not really human. They have no, I mean, if you do something bad, or I do, we know we've done it, and we might feel shame about it, right?
Yeah.
They don't.
Yeah.
I'll
give
you one example from the
Wait, because we only have a couple of minutes. I've been alluding to the fact that I think you grew up with this. And you said to me, yes, you did, right?
Yeah, but what I'm trying to tell you...
I know what you're trying to tell me, but I'm trying to show people that there's a certain sensitivity we get to it also, because when it's in your family, when you have a father who seems to be like that, it's brutal. Brutal. More brutal than anything anybody could imagine.
And what about when we have presidents and secretaries of state?
Sure. They were all... Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'll give you one example. Madeleine Albright, when she was asked about the 500,000 children in Iraq who the sanctions killed, she said, we think the price was worth it.
Hmm.
Now, would you do that? Would I do that? No. We would feel shame. They don't.
They're
not like other humans. Unfortunately, they make their way to the tops of many organizations.
And families.
They tip the organization or the family, however you... into that sickness. And I think that's the point we've reached in this country.
Thank you very much for calling in. I have to be going. Thank you for your contribution. Bye-bye. Well, my friends. Sometimes you hear the pain underneath the pain, you know? Hey, I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. with more stuff. Special thanks, Jeremy Spiegel, Dr. Jeremy Spiegel, for being with us. And I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Here's a little Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, Moaning.
WBAI is een niet-commerciële zender, gesponsord
Ciao,
door luisteraars.
Ciao, e quando sono a New York, ascolto WBAI su 99.5 FM.
Nitko Jacqueline Murekatete, dumure scapio a genocidi a Batruzzi, a vai manu nuotiene na cane Murwanda.
Murimo kumba. Когато съм в Нью-Йорк, аз винаги слушам WBAI 98.5.
Ми номер е Елса. Анто сам пърмите ми радио синтониса на 99.5 FM WBAI.
What language do you speak when you call back home and talk to your grandmother or cousins? Join WBAI's ongoing community outreach and produce a station ID for us in your native tongue. You can contact the program coordinator, Michael G. Haskins, at wbaiannouncements@gmail.com. Let's honor each other.
Somewhere between the light of day and edge of night lies the 5 o'clock shadow. Cutting Edge Journalism with Robert Knight. Exploring domestic and international affairs with live interviews and produced segments and a daily war summary. On the Razor's Edge with Robert Knight. That's 5 o'clock shadow on WBAI 99.5 FM, Monday through Thursday at the obvious time.
WBAI will be celebrating women with a special IWWD broadcast by and about women with politics, music, health, talk, and live performance.
Wait a minute. What does IWWD means?
IWWD stands for International Working Women's Day, which takes place March 8th, 12 a.m. till March 9th.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.